Good evening. My name is Shane Chebsey, and this is the Icecast. And on the Icecast, we talk to comic artists and writers and publishers about their lives, their work, and everything in between. And this evening on the Icecast, I am joined for the first time by two guests. It is the golden couple of indie comics, Damien and Helena Edwardson. Good evening, guys.
Good evening, Shane.
You all right, Shane?
I'm very well. I'm very good, thank you. How are you guys doing tonight?
Yeah, really well, thanks. Really good.
Yeah, excellent.
We're doing all right.
It's looking forward to the next lockdown, eh?
I know. Yeah.
We've never been out of it.
I know, nothing's changed for us, really.
It's like Greater Manchester. It's like we're constantly locked down or not locked down, and nobody knows whether we're locked down or we're not locked down, so we're just presuming we're just locked down forever.
Just go safe.
Well, a bit of me does quite like it, you know.
Yeah.
Because people get on my nerves anyway. So it's a good excuse, isn't it, to go like, I'm sorry, I can't come round. Yeah. You know, we're in lockdown, Dad. I'm trying to keep it going as long as I can. Even when we're not in lockdown, I'd be like, no, our street's in lockdown, Dad.
Yeah. Terrible. Haven't you heard?
Can't even go to the shops. Yeah. I'm only joking, Dad, if you're listening.
Yeah, you better apologise now. Yeah.
I'm sure he's not. So it's great to have you both on tonight, and because obviously both of you work on art projects, but quite differently. You work in the same environment, but do different stuff as well. So how does that, well, I suppose my first question is, how does it work with when you're both working together? Are you in close proximity, or do you have to like stay apart, or you'll like sort of eat each other alive?
I think it's quite funny because you're not the first person to ask that as far as, you know, how do we manage working together insofar as, are we in competition? Do we work in the same room, you know, and how does that all work? And it actually works incredibly well because we both work, as you've just mentioned, we both have very different styles in the way that we work. And we do work, we've got a little home studio, which sounds more glamorous than it actually is, really. It's just a bit of loft space. And we have our own little corners. And sometimes, as antisocial as this might sound, we can go up into the studio sometimes and we cannot actually speak to each other for about 3 hours because we're in our own little zones. We're listening to podcasts, you know, whatever it may be. And it's only when one of us goes, oh, do you want a brew? You know, we'll go make a coffee, or we'll ask each other's opinion on stuff. And that works really well because somebody asked us that, saying, you know, do you ask to critique each other's work and do you fall out over it? Mm. And it's like, no, we're mature enough to take criticism. And for, you know, I'm doing something, I'll say, look, I think there's something wrong with this. Will you look over it for me? Tell me what it is. I can see there's something wrong. And Damon will look at it and go, yeah, you need to move that ear, or that doesn't, you need to add a bit of this. And it's like, and at no point do I go, huh, how dare you? Because at the end of the day, I've asked him for a reason, you know, and vice versa. He'll ask me and say, what's wrong with this? Is there something that needs changing on it? Mm. And at no point does he ever take umbrage over it. So that, we've got a really good working relationship, haven't we?
Yeah, I learned about telling people to move things back 2 millimetres in art college. So you might remember that, mate.
I think we all learned that lesson, didn't we? I mean, I should disclose to the viewers that the three of us know each other pretty well. We go quite far back. We used to go to art college. Yes.
Good grief.
30 years. Stop pretending you're only 25. You were in college 30 years ago.
Get away with it.
How long ago? I knew you when you had her.
Yeah. You did. You did. Yeah. And I knew you when you were tubby.
And I still am.
Oh, get away with you,
but
man.
I wasn't great.
Yeah, I know. But no, it does work really well, though. I mean, we had the loft converted into a studio space.
Yeah.
And it's kind of split into two halves. So H has one end of the loft, which is the tidy end. And I have all the shit at my end.
I am quite a
shitty end.
But it works really well, actually. And it's nice. It's a nice space. And it's very kind of strange. It's like being in a sound booth a bit, because it's actually quite silent up there until the dog starts howling. But it is, it's lovely. And you do find yourself kind of really concentrating on what you're doing. Whereas previously, when we got back into art, because we hadn't, you know, we gave up for about 20 years after we left college.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you about, actually, because obviously we kept in touch a little bit, but we did have, you know, periods, didn't we, where we didn't keep in touch because you guys moved quite far away. And
wore off and you tracked us down.
Well, yeah. stalked you.
Yeah, bloody hell, it's Shane again.
Fucking hell, he's wrote us a letter. I remember getting a handwritten letter from you guys.
Oh, actually, God.
Yeah.
That's how old we are, isn't it, Jesus?
Yeah. Who does that anymore? Handwritten letters.
I know. You're
going to have to explain what a letter is, aren't you?
Yeah, to all the younger listeners, yeah. A letter?
Pen to paper.
But no, it was good. And like I said, we didn't do any art for a long time. And then we started doing it again. And we used to work on the kitchen table, didn't we? You know, one at one and one at the other. But by the time you got all the stuff out and set it all up,
yeah,
it's time to go to bed.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, you know, bugger this. So we decided that, you know, we were going to sort of get the loft sorted out, and we did. And it's been brilliant. I mean, that we can only do as much work as we do because we did that, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because
people
always say, God, you churn a lot of stuff out. You know, you're always doing stuff, and it's because we've got a space that we can go up, work, and just leave it. You know, and it's amazing that. It's an amazing thing to do, and I'm really glad we did it.
Oh, God, yeah, it's one of the best things. I mean, we've done a lot of, like, bits of work on the house as we've can afford it. You know, we've done had some, you know, quite some serious work done, and that was one of the ones where we kept putting it off going, oh, we're never going to be able to afford to do this, because it was already converted. It was just badly done.
Yeah.
And there was no insulation and stuff like that, and we thought, this would make a lovely studio, but we just put it off. Then when we got a quote, we went, this is affordable, we can do this, you know. And then we did it and thought, God, I'm so... And it's paid for itself, you know, over again, over and over again.
Yeah,
you know?
I bet it has. And so what was it that made you decide, you know, after that break, to sort of get back into doing art again?
I think it probably stems from... I'm talking a good few years, about 2014, I think it was. I decided I wanted to get back into it myself. And I know Damien hadn't done much and wasn't really, you know, massively interested as such. I dabbled a little bit, but 2014, I won't bother going into the whys and wheres of why I did it, but I decided I wanted to do something in the community.
Right.
So, and something artistic. So I ended up by a set of sort of speaking to certain people and asking some, you know, making some phone calls, speaking to people within the council and stuff like that. I ended up running an art group in my local library.
Yeah.
And it was mainly because they'd had this room that was just a dumping ground. They'd converted it into a gallery. And I thought, oh, this is really nice. So I was chatting with one of the ladies who worked there. She goes, it'd be lovely if you could put on art lessons. And I went, ooh, you know. So to cut a very long story short, I offered up my time purely voluntarily to get people involved in art.
Yeah.
And that was this kind of thing to get footfall into the library, because obviously libraries have always been under threat of closure and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I won't go into the politics of all that, but I ended up getting, you know, starting that. And it was weird because I started doing it. I thought, I think I've made a grave mistake here, because the first time they had a big opening of the gallery, a load of people came, and then they petered off, and then I'd have one person turn up, and then I had one week I had nobody turn up. I thought,
oh, that's disheartening, isn't it?
Disheartening. I thought, oh, God, you know. So anyway, I spoke to a couple of people who I knew people who were looking at doing art, and I went, get them to come along. And they went, oh, how much is this? It's free, you know. And I went from having a couple of people to, in the end, having about 30 people I had to cram into this tiny gallery. And some of them, I had to sit them on kids' seats that were around the corner of the kids' area in the library. And it was lovely. And I don't want this to sound like I'm blowing my own trumpet here, but word got out and people went, this is a really nice art group.
Yeah, you got a nice little community.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
And I mean, the ages ranged. It was predominantly kind of the older generation. And what was lovely about it was some of them were carers. They were looking after partners, or they were widows or widowers. And they came out on that Saturday morning, and that was their social time.
Oh, right.
And,
yeah.
You know, I would stand and teach them, and I'd give them demos and that kind of stuff. And then from that, Damien went, oh, you know, this is really, you've really inspired me to sort of start doing some artwork here.
Great.
And then I'll hand over to you now to explain how you got into sort of doing that.
Yeah. Now Damien's going to say, that was a load of shit. She's just talking about her
that's
arse,
not how it went.
Didn't tell you about all the rabid grannies trying to get me to take my togs off and do an art thing. I only did it once, and we had to ban one woman for trying to do a rubbing. You know what I mean? But, yeah, so H was, like I say, she was running this art class, and, you know, it kind of piqued your interest a bit. And I was at a point where I needed to do something to help me relax, because I was a bit stressed out at the time.
Yeah, you felt the need to sort of do something that you could just concentrate on.
I just couldn't switch off. I had a lot going on, and I was in a weird place, and I couldn't switch off. And I remember going to the doctors once and saying, like, you know, well, what do you love doing? And I'm like, nothing. I was in that kind of space. And they're like, what did you used to do? And I said, I used to like art. And why don't you do some drawing? And I was like, oh, I haven't done it for 20 years. I probably can't do it now. And then I came home and I was talking to her. She said, why don't you just do some stuff, sit down. Yeah. And do you know what? It was amazing. As soon as I started just doing it, firstly, I realised I could actually still, well, this is probably, you know, my opinion is I could still actually paint and draw, and some people would argue otherwise. And secondly, I just thought, do you know what? I wished I'd carried on doing this all the years.
Yeah, you always think that after a break, don't you?
Do, you know what? Really do.
Yeah, you can't live your life. Why did I stop?
Yeah, I know.
But you can't. You can't actually live your life doing that. Looking back and thinking, why did I waste 20 years of not doing art? Because I could have been half decent now. Mm. You actually just think, do you know what? I'm back in it, and now I'm gonna make it. You know, I'm gonna really seriously get my head down and crack on with it. And that's what we did, wasn't it?
So, and you have done, and you've created, you know, you've created this brand between the two of you. You know, you're obviously doing different things, but you've created this joint brand that people are aware of, and you're doing such a variety of work. And it's really cool, you know? And so going into that, obviously you're doing different things. Damien, you're doing your comics and your portraits and things like that. Helena, you've done portraits as well, but you're also doing like pet portraits, you're doing your teaching and all that. I mean, it's a real breadth of different types of art, isn't it?
Yeah.
And have you made that work as a sort of as a business, or is it just more of a sideline, or, you know, is it something that is it comparable to the time that you're putting into it? Are you getting out of it? You know,
it's funny because when I was doing running the art group, it got to a point where the art group got unwieldy. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. What I mean was that I was putting so much kind of time into it. And I loved it because I'm one of these people that does all the prep and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It got to a point where I thought, I now want to do some work for me. So I kind of thought, I can't do work for me and do the art group. Yeah. So I ended up stepping away. And then I stepped away, but it was lovely because when I did step away, I told them, I said, look, you know, I'm kind of stepping down, if you will. And one of them said, well, can we carry on without you? I said, of course you can carry on without me. You don't need me. You're confident enough. You can go ahead and do it. And then from kind of stepping away from that, at the same time, people started saying to us, do you do these? Do you do commissions? Do you do this? Do you do, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm. That's what we do, but we've got no legal way of selling our work, because at no point did we want to, you know, sell it kind of underhandedly. We didn't want to not pay our taxes and that kind of stuff. Because the last thing you want is somebody from the Department of, I forgot what it's called. I wanted to call it the IRS, but that's in America.
Yeah,
you know? You know,
the Gestapo, I call them.
Yeah. Asking you for a commission.
Inland Revenue,
yeah. Asking you for a commission. And you go, yeah, that'll be however much. And they go, right, you know, you're not paying tax on this. Yeah. So from that, we decided to set up the business, didn't we, as a legitimate way of taking money for things that we do. Mm. And that was like predominantly, you know, little portrait commissions that you do. I started doing pet portraits. I did one as a gift for somebody, put it on social media. Went, can you draw my dog? Can you draw my cat?
Yeah.
So we thought, do you know what? Let's just do this. Let's start the business and have like a 3-year plan. And the idea is that, and when we spoke to an accountant, he said that what normally happens, he said, your first year, you'll make a loss. The second year, ideally, you'll break even. The third year, make a profit. He said, and if it doesn't go like that, he said, you need to start really looking at whether or not this is working. He said, not only that, they start questioning. If you're not making a profit, they start questioning, going, is this a legitimate business if you keep money back off them? You know,
kind of thing. They don't like it, do they?
They don't like it at all. No. So we thought, you know what? We've got nothing to lose. Let's give it a go. Let's try this. And then quite right, like you're saying, Shane, it's a very eclectic, wide variety of stuff that we do, which is good because when neither of us are treading on each other's toes, you know, we do very different stuff and have quite a different style, you know, and that's the way it sort of came from, wasn't it?
So really? we tried to split it into two types of identities, really. So we've got, it all comes under Art 92.
Yeah.
But we have Art 92 Studios, which is the kind of portrait stuff that we do and the commission stuff. And then we have Art 92 Comics, which is obviously you never guess, folks, but that's where you do stuff. You know what I mean? And I do stand up and things like that. But that's what we do. And we just try and have that little bit of separation because if we'd have branded ourselves Art 92 Studios, what we realized was that people didn't make that association with that and the comics. It was a bit weird. It sounded a bit up its own ass because it's like, well, you're not Marvel Studios or something. You're not like, no. And if we'd have called ourselves Art 92 Comics, that would have stopped people coming down the kind of art route. You know? So we just thought we'll try and keep it a little bit separate. And the first comic That we did, obviously, we did Between Us. So H did a first sort of comic strip.
Was that your first comic, was it, H?
The first comic I'd ever done.
Pre-Mortis that we did was the first thing that we ever did. And we thought we'd give it a go because, you know, we'd obviously been to ICE, and which, you know, very kindly I did the poster for that year and stuff. And
yeah, it was a great bit of art, that as well, mate.
Oh, thank you. We've been noodling away with the idea of doing, you know, self-published stuff. But you got to remember, when we were doing Art Chain 30 years ago, you couldn't, you'll know, because you used to do publishing stuff, but how hard was it and how expensive?
Oh, it was hard work, mate. It was really difficult. You really had to put a lot in to self-publish back in the 90s.
Yeah. Massive risk, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And
now,
when you look at, you know, companies that will publish comics, you know, you get them set up. You know, if you can set them up yourself and lay them out and send them off as a printable file, the cost of doing it means it's still not cheap, but it means it's affordable for you to actually get your work out there, and that's what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
So we thought, right, let's give it a go, and we did Pre-Mortis, and that was really, really well received, actually. And we're working on the second issue now. Well, I'm sure we'll come on to that later on, but
good stuff.
It went down well, but that was the first time that either of us really had done a proper comic that was going to go out to people, you know, hopefully to buy. And that was a learning curve.
I bet it was. So what things did you learn on that curve? What sort of almost knocks you off your stride, as it were? Was there anything in particular that you found a real challenge?
Yeah, for me, it was the great RGBCMYK file conversion debacle that nearly killed me.
It did.
When's red not red?
Yeah.
In CMYK.
Yeah.
Oh, grey, didn't you, when you were doing that?
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it?
Oh, the amount of and again, it was the first time, and it was basically we learned everything, to be honest, from laying out panels to, you know, to actually, because H isn't a big comics reader.
No, I was going to say that, because it was a huge learning curve for me, because
the language of comics itself, you know.
It's kind of, I'm not a comics reader, and it's nothing to do with the fact I don't like comics by any stretch, but Damien had the kind of the experience of reading comics and knowing how things should flow, and you know, and having, like, you know, the strip and things like that. So for me, it was like a completely new concept altogether.
Yeah,
you know?
So we had all that, and then we had things like, you know, lettering, which is the devil's work, isn't
it?
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And just everything. But I'll tell you what, though, we really, really enjoyed it. We put everything we could into
labor
it.
Of love.
Spent like weeks, didn't we? You know, I mean, we turned it round in I think when we did a count, I think we got the whole thing done in about 8 weeks from deciding we were doing it. You know, but that was 8 solid weeks.
Of
every night, every weekend, like just up there constantly working away at it.
Yeah.
And then
it's not just doing the work, is it? It's not just doing the drawing or the writing. It's everything else as well.
Yeah.
You're doing it yourself. Yeah.
And so we turned it around relatively quickly, but that was because we were doing, you know, half a book each, essentially. But it was a great learning curve. And then obviously we've taken that forward into other things. And the things you learn as well are useful for other work. So when I'm doing, you know, other commissions now, digital commissions, the good thing is, because I've learned the great colour catastrophe that is working in the wrong bloody, you know, mode, I've always got that in my mind now. So it just makes things easier, doesn't it? And you know, you make less mistakes as you go ahead. And
definitely.
And you improve as well. You know, you just try and get better every time you do something. And you know, you're always your worst critic.
Of course.
You
know? So
I always say I hate everything I do from the minute I finish it.
I think we all do that, don't we? Yeah.
Halfway through, I'll think, this is all right. This time I finish it, I'm like, oh, God. You know,
by the time it's in print, you hate it.
Yeah, but I'm getting less like that now.
Well, you just move on to the next project, don't you? I think that's the way to do it. Is, you know, you feel like, oh, I'm not going to look at that anymore. I've done that. I'm moving forward. I keep developing, keep moving forward. I mean, last year and the year before as well, I mean, you guys were really prolific. You know, you were pumping out quite a lot of work. I mean, for you...
We were quite surprised, weren't we, how much work we actually put out, really.
Well,
I was looking back, and since last October, when we did the first... Pre-Mortis, we've put out between us 5, 6 books.
Yeah.
You know, so we've had a couple of the wrestling GGA books. We've had Pre-Mortis 1. H did a short story, sort of semi-autobiographical story about her and a little green bike. She's done a how-to book on drawing animals, a couple of sketchbooks. So we've actually, you know, already built up a level of work that's, you know, means that we can have a table with all our own stuff. And that's the proudest bit.
Yeah.
You know, when you're at a con, I mean, I'm sure people remember cons, and one day we get them back again.
I hope so, mate.
You know, when you've got a table full of your own original stuff, it's it's amazing that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're really proud of it, aren't we? And, you know, we don't claim to be the best and all that, but do you know what? We try our best with everything we do.
Yeah, which is enjoying it as well.
You can say, can't you? That's yours, you know. There's no, you know, that is your work. Everything on that table is down to you guys.
And we know and we've put into things and how much, you know, we've worried about it. And you'll know this, Shane, is when you send something off to print, you're absolutely crapping yourself waiting for it to come back, thinking, oh God, you know, and then you've got to put it out there to people. And, you know, every time you do that, we worry about everything we do, don't we, really? But that's just in our nature. We're on, like you said, we're on our own worst critics,
and
aren't we?
I think the day that we stop worrying about it is the day we'd probably pack it in again.
Yeah, because you don't care then, do you? If you don't care enough to worry, you know, if you just, if you become complacent and you're just putting books out or whatever, or pieces of art, and you're not really having any emotional sort of feeling with it.
Exactly,
no point in doing it anymore, is there?
Yeah.
If it becomes a sausage machine, it's time to, you know, cut the sausages off, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, it's just, you're not giving anything any different. And you see this with pros sometimes, don't you, where you can tell they're dialing it in a bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a bit disappointed and think, I'll take a break if I were you.
Yeah, and you do see it a lot with pros, actually. And and it's really good when you see them sort of hit that sort of point where they've got to that, but then maybe they take a hit, maybe they lose some work, and they have a rethink. And you can tell that's happened because suddenly they start putting out loads of really good work, and it's really different to anything they've done before. And you know that somewhere in their career, they've had some sort of knock to make that happen, to make them think, what am I doing wrong? And it's then made them, you know, sort of re-examine what they're doing. And it's a good result for most times.
It can be a plateau as well, can't it? You know, because sometimes you get to the point where your work doesn't improve. You know, I always believe if you get too comfortable in a certain style, that, you know, you're never going to progress and get better, because you'll just become very proficient in that style, which is great. And it may catch a wave for a while, but then after a while, it may also then kind of just become lost in a sea of other similar work where people are doing things like that.
Yeah, that can happen.
We always try and you know, improve things. And it's the same with the comics. I mean, if you look at Galaxy Grappling 1 and 2, they're very different in the style, because I did the first one. You know, it was a learning curve, because it's bloody hard doing a wrestling comic, I tell you.
I wanted to ask that, actually. What was your inspiration for doing a wrestling comic?
Because I always loved wrestling as a kid. And even through my teens, I loved the pantomime of it all. It fascinates me. As I've kind of gotten older, you have a penchant for going back and looking at stuff from your youth, don't you? And I went back and I realised again just how much fun it was. I mean, I don't watch modern wrestling now, because I just find it a bit too serious. It takes itself far too seriously. But back in that 80s, to early 90s period, when you had, you know, the WWF exploded, and you had
it
was all like cartoon characters, larger than life, you know, brighter than you've ever seen, and that really stuck with me. And I loved that, and I loved the kind of messaging around things like Star Trek, you know, where there was a moral kind of core to Star Trek, and this thing about, you know, essentially Kirk would do anything before he'd start fighting. You know, he would try whatever he could.
Oh, yeah.
And usually ended up with him punching someone in the face and stabbing the missus, didn't it? But he'd try and not avoid that to start with.
For a while. Yeah. And then it would be like, fire all phasers!
Come here, cocker! So I liked that, and I tried to bring the kind of sci-fi and the wrestling thing together, and thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, I'll set it in the future, and I'll set it in a landscape where essentially there are no wars, because there's this thing called the Piper Accord, where all disputes, whether they're trade disputes or you know, anything, they're all resolved by having a wrestling match, which is
a genuine fight.
And it's all sanctioned by this one major corporation called the GGA, which rules all of these matches and chooses the opponents, chooses where they are, what kind of matches they are, and stuff like that. So the first one dealt with basically like slavery was the, you know, the dispute was around slavery of these people who were kind of.
It's captive. Almost like gladiatorial, isn't it?
Yeah. And the second one was about kind of like health and medicine. It was about supplies, getting supplies to people, and how, you know, major corporations didn't want to release them because they couldn't afford them. And so there's this kind of moral kind of undertone. I mean, no spoiler, but it doesn't always end well. It doesn't. No. You know, they don't. It's not like your typical wrestling arc. No. You know, the hero comes in and he starts fighting, and then it looks like he's losing, and then he hooks up and he wins it. There doesn't always work that way.
Yeah.
So trying to keep it kind of a bit more interesting, and the problem with the wrestling as a comic is though, and I was explaining this to H, is it's difficult to get a lot of character narrative in there because. Yeah. A lot of people who buy it, and I get a lot of people from America who buy it, actually. The last Kickstarter I did, about three quarters of it went to the States.
Really? Is this because they just want the action?
They want the wrestling. So if you do like, you know, I did 24 pages last time, and if at least, you know, three quarters of them aren't action, that's what they want.
Yeah.
Because I've looked at wrestling books before I started doing it, and it's like about three panels, and like, that's not a wrestling match, is it?
No.
You can't tell the whole journey of a wrestling match and the story arc in three panels.
Mm.
So I tried to do that, but on the next one, I'm going to try and flip it a little bit. Mm. So it's a bit more about people and characters, because I want to build this kind
Well, you've got the world it's set in, haven't you? You want to do a little bit of world building, don't you? And get, you know, because obviously you don't want every issue to just be a long wrestling match. You want to build
your characters, don't you? It's a draw.
Yeah.
Not only is fighting, and as you know, trying to draw a fight and trying to draw motion is art.
It's the, it's
then
the
you realise there's a crowd, so you've got to draw them.
Oh, God.
And you just think, do you know what I mean? And again, because I won't kind of just do, you know, I won't do like the very, very briefest indication. I will try and at least make it look realistic in the sense that there are other things in the background.
Yeah.
In a bit more detail. It's a nightmare sometimes. So, yeah, it'd be quite nice to do a bit more of you know, a talking heads bit, really, just to get
a break. Just have a break from it, yeah.
Yeah, but it is good, though. I do enjoy doing it, and I've had some really good feedback on it.
I've heard good things. I mean, do you enjoy the writing side of it as well? Because obviously you're creating the story. You know, because that's something different, isn't it? That's a different discipline. Have you found that you've fallen into that quite easily, or have you found that challenging?
I wouldn't say I've fallen into it easily. I mean, H is lucky because she is a writer, so she can write and she can draw on everything else. So we'll just ignore her. And talk about me and my failings. Thanks, Jay.
I'm not sure how I can write, but yeah.
But, you know, so writing I find the most difficult bit, and you know, I have to really work on that. The art, you know, the art's difficult, but it's only difficult because I want to get it right, and I'm never pleased with anything. But at least I know where to start with the artwork. With the writing, it can be very difficult. And I think as the story goes along, it will get easier because I will have more sort of context to set around the characters. So But yeah, that's the most difficult bit for me.
Mm.
What do you want me to say?
I was going to say, tell them what you can't do.
The list is too
what
long.
Can't you do, say anything, Ben. Just silence, I can do everything.
Amateur,
don't you know?
I can't draw or write comics. There you go.
Give over. The thing that people liked about Pre-Mortis, actually, because it was two stories in one book. So H did the first story and I did the second story. And H's was a standalone and mine is a continuation, which I'm just going to start on the second part now. But what people did like about that were the styles were completely different.
Mm.
You know, so mine was in kind of painted colour and H's was primarily black and white with red, and they looked different as well, which because we've got very different styles, and it worked really well, I think, and we got a lot of good feedback about that people liked the fact that it looked so different, you know. So when H says she can't write and draw comics, she's talking absolute crap.
but to be honest, to be brutally honest, when we went into doing that comic, I didn't have a clue how I was going to attack it. I had no idea. I didn't know what style to do it in. I didn't know when to do it full colour. I really didn't have a clue, and I just noodled with it initially. And then when I started work on it, when I did the first page and then started working my way through it, my style changed so dramatically that I had to redo the first page again.
Why?
Because it looked shit. And then I could see myself kind of getting better and better. When I said in my own eyes how I figured I was looking better than I did in the first one.
Yeah.
When I look back I thought, Christ, the first page looks like it's been done by somebody completely different. So I had to go back and change it. And by the end of it, I really liked the style that I was working in. And when I come to do the second issue of it, I'll work in the same style. Otherwise, what we don't want is people picking up and going, oh, who's this then? I want it to look like it. The first one.
It's in continuation.
Yeah.
It is tricky, isn't it? I remember I got into inking a couple of years ago, did a few inking jobs. And when I started, because I was learning on the job, as it were, you know, because I could ink, but I wasn't very good because I'd never been an inker. But I wanted to learn the craft of inking. Mm. So I thought the best way to learn is doing. So I did this 32-page comic on this one job. And the first page, I looked at it afterwards, you know, after finishing the whole project. I just thought, that first page is just terrible. You know, I was so ashamed of it. I was actually ashamed of it. But the last four or five pages, I was thinking, I'm into my groove, man.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, find your groove, don't you?
You do get it, don't you? But you need to do, I think you need to do about 20 pages.
Yeah, you know, just warm up, pages.
Well, it's that thing, though, isn't it? They reckon it takes, what is it, 6,000 hours to become good at something, you know? And so, you know, if you take inking, because everybody thinks inking's dead easy, you think you just trace over the top of the pencil.
Yeah.
And it's nothing of the sort, is it?
No, it's really difficult. I find it difficult anyway.
I've found as I work now that my pencils have got less tight and I actually tighten up when I'm doing the inking over the top. You know, that's where I really, because otherwise what I'll do is I'll spend so long penciling that it's almost too busy to ink then.
You can't have fun with it. You can't give it life. Yeah. Because that's where the life comes in, isn't it? The movement and the style all comes in on the inking. And you do everything digitally now, don't you, Damer?
In the comic side, So I do still work physically. I do still do physical stuff. Mainly when I'm doing commissions and stuff, I like to work painting and drawing and sketching and stuff. Because I think it is important to keep your kind of physical skills up. But I do work... probably 90% digital now. And all the comic stuff I do is digital. I may rough it out in pencil and thumbnail it out, but I will always kind of commit to it in digital. And that was a learning curve because when I decided I was going to learn to draw digitally, we invested in some equipment to do it because I'm going to do it, right? I don't want to do it like try and fudge it. And then that restricts me and then I just go, oh, I can't do this and give up. Yeah, I thought, I'm gonna give myself the best opportunity I could. So I invested in a bit of equipment, bought a tablet and started doing it. And then I just thought, well, that was a complete waste of money, wasn't it? Because this is a nightmare. And I really thought I'd never, ever get the hang of it. And I thought, no, I can't. So I bought books and I watched videos and I just kept practicing.
Just applied yourself, basically, mate.
And actually, I've got to say, it was Ryan Brown, a little friend of ours, who actually really helped me the most, because I was talking to him and I was saying, look, you know, I'm really struggling with this. And, you know, I mean, he's a fantastic artist. In fact, you can't tell the difference between the two, which is
His digital stuff looks like paint, doesn't it? And vice versa, you know, he's got this style that it just works for both.
And he sort of said to me, look, you know, you need to approach it like you would with a physical painting. And I'm like, right. And he said, don't use all the filters and don't use all that shit.
No.
He said, just treat it like you would a physical painting. Use the opacity to just build up colours rather than just trying to pick the colour and all that sort of stuff. And do you know what? It was like a revelation.
Yeah.
When I came back and I approached, and it was just approaching it differently. You know, so sketching it out digitally and then, you know, inking something digitally and painting something digitally. And I took the same approach that I do when I work physically. And it was incredible the difference it made.
Yeah.
So that was probably practice and a bit of sound advice.
Yeah.
And when we had him on the podcast and he was talking about
I listened to that. It was a good one.
Yeah. And the process stuff he was talking about was fascinating about, you know, things to bear in mind that, you know, if you want light, you've got to have dark, you know, and stuff like that. And if you want a warm color, you've got to have a cool color to actually help it pop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all digital now. And the difference again between GGA 1 and 2 was the first time when I did GGA 1, basically I painted it, digitally painted it like I did with Pre-Mortis.
Right.
And I wanted a different look to it. I wanted it to look a bit more 80s comic book sort of style.
like a traditional comics, what people call comics
so
style.
I thought, right, I did the one thing that I never do, and that was I sat down, I did a course, a proper course. I basically got myself a course and I worked through it. And it was from a colorist through this thing. And again, it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. It's changed the way I work because it absolutely made me think about coloring in a completely different way. You know, learning to flat properly.
Yeah.
That gives you and people think, well, why would you do that? You know, but flatting gives you the ability to go back and just work sections of the, later on and stuff as you.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah.
And it's just little things like that. And I really enjoyed it because I hate doing courses. I used to train for years and I was the worst person to be trained because I just thought, I wouldn't have done it like that. But I thought, no, I've got to kind of persevere with this. And it's changed the way I approach all my work now, actually.
Really?
So you just got to learn and just keep learning and keep improving and keep working. But I've said to people that have come to me and said, like, well, I'm thinking of starting painting digitally and what should I do? And the first thing I just said is you've just got to just keep going. Don't get disheartened with it because it will look like a pile of shit when you start. And even when you know what you're doing, it's like a painting. You get halfway through.
Yeah. Still make
it go.
What's
this?
What have I done?
And you get to that point, don't you, where you think, do I carry on or do I bin it
scrap
and start again? You know, and every piece of work I've ever done has had that phase and still does, but it's the confidence to know, it looks like a pile of shit, but I know that I'm going to be able to turn it around when I get to this stage and that stage.
Yeah, so
it's just that. But I enjoy the digital stuff. It's good. It's got its drawbacks, you know. Like I say, the colours are a bit of a pain sometimes, you know, because what you're trying to calibrate your monitors and all that gubbins, you know.
And of course, the biggest drawback of working digitally is that you can't sell original art.
Exactly. That is a bit of a pain. But you know, you find ways around it. Well, now what I do is with some pages, because I physically draw them sometimes, I'll actually sit and I'll draw out a page in a bit more detail, and you know, then you get people who want those pages, you know, certain pages.
Got you.
And commissions as well, you know. Yeah. So you just keep your hand in with commissions. But that is a drawback. I mean, I know that's the thing Brian Bolland always says, isn't it, is that the problem is he doesn't have any original pages anymore, which is a real shame. But you know, if he did, we wouldn't afford them, would we?
Well, there is that. Yeah, but I think there is something very special about original art, isn't there? You know, when you can see the artist's brush strokes and you can see the intentions of the artist on the page, can't you?
Yeah.
With a piece of original art.
I love old ink pages as well. You know, I've got a few original pages, and I just love ink on page on a comic page.
Isn't it?
I've got a few John McCrae pages because I love his style, and you know, and I've got a Jim Aparo page as well, which I've got, and it's just beautiful. You know, when you see the ink slightly sort of settle at a different tone to the and I've always said that, you know, and I read this and I thought, and I had a flick through some of the ink pages, and I read this thing saying, if you want to learn to ink, look at some original ink pages of people who can ink really well. And it's true, because the best reproduction in the world isn't the same. Doesn't give you the same feel.
It's fascinating, isn't it, to look at those pages.
It's an art. It's a real art form as well.
And you learn as well some of the shortcuts that professionals can get away with, because I had a lot of pages from certain artists, and I would be amazed at how much corrective fluid there would be on some of the pages. How much marker pen, and how many times they might stick a piece of paper with a different drawing on a section, because the editor might say, "Oh, you can't show her pants, come on."
We've got a John McCrae piece that he did from when he did the sequel in honor of Steve Dillon, and Cry the Werewolf sequel. And we bought a page. We've got a couple of pages from that, but there's one page where he's essentially got an entirely different drawing taped over the top of the original because he didn't like it. And he was showing us, he was flipping it up and down. Look at this. Look at this.
It's like a flip book, wouldn't it?
It's a bit like the optional nudie lady in Bad News, the old TV thing where they have on the desk of the van, they've got the optional nudie lady, which you can flip up and down when you feel like. And it was like that. And but I love all that. The tactile nature of it. And I do miss that. And I am tempted to do a purely physical book one day. where
just
I
just to get into it again, just to feel.
Yeah, but I'd have to buy a big scanner, so yeah, that's what puts me off.
Well, they're expensive as well, aren't they? A3 scanners.
I've only got an A4 scanner, and I'm like, oh, I can't be arsed, so I'll just keep it digital for now. But yeah, it is a beautiful, beautiful piece of art to do it physically.
Yeah.
And both of you, I've got a question for both of you. I mean, who are your influences on the work that you're doing now? Like, where did it come from? Because I actually find it quite hard to see, because both of your styles are quite distinctive and very much, from what I can tell, your own. I can look at your work, Damien, and I can see that's your work. I know straight away.
Yeah.
Look at your work, H, and I can tell that's your work, you know? But obviously, in there are influences from other artists, probably not comic artists, I would imagine, because, like, you know, like me, you guys come from a illustration background as well. But I am interested in how your styles have grown and where they've come from influence wise.
I'll let you answer that first.
That means she's thinking of the answer.
To be honest, you've hit the nail on the head, because you're right, because I'm not
Everyone else is crap, isn't it? That's what
you go first, then she goes first. You tell that story about the time when so and so happened, and I'll start. She go, no, you're not telling it right.
I'll tell it.
Go on then. What's your influences?
No, I'm speaking because you've hit the nail on the head. As far as I don't know how to answer that, because
why?
I can say I've got people that I admire, you know, and I'll look at their work and admire it. And I know certainly when I was in college, there'd be people that I admire their elements and try and do some of that, you know, in my work and what have you. But I have no one person. I can pick up some work in a shop or a market or whatever, when we used to go outside in the outside world, and I'd see stuff, and it doesn't have to be by anybody in particular. I just see something and think, oh, I like that. I picked up that influenced me. Or I'll see something on YouTube. I'll be looking through YouTube for one thing, and I'll see something else. I'll go, oh, I'll follow them. And I'll find them on Instagram and follow them, and they'll influence me. But they're nobody. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. They're not.
Yeah, there's not somebody. Famous. Yeah,
I know their work, kind of thing.
Mm.
So I will follow animal artists. I'll follow portrait artists. I follow people who work in a particular medium that maybe I'm not very confident in, so I can look at how they will tackle stuff.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, you know, there's certain mediums that I've not been confident in, but I've wanted to be. So I've gone on YouTube and just looked at a variety of people, and then taken elements of all those bits of people, no one person, and then put my own slant in it, you know.
Right, yeah.
As far as when it came to doing the comic, I did panic slightly and said to Damien, can you point me in the right direction of some comics that might influence me and inspire me, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't take anybody's style because... and you can tell, because I did somebody pointed this out and said my side of the comic was very much like a talking head, because it was all close up of the heads. And I hadn't really thought about that. And afterwards, oh, yes, that was my intention. It wasn't. I just didn't know what I was doing, you know.
You felt comfortable drawing, you know, faces and talking heads because you do a lot of portrait work. And
I do. Yes. And I thought, I did think, shit, I've not done any kind of, you know, background or scenery with it. And, oh, God, you know. But then again, maybe that's a good thing. Because like Damien said, you're doing a fight scene. You've got a crowd scene or whatever. It's like, oh, Jesus, I don't want to deal with that. But you
can't be asked for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Rub it in, won't you? my next story is going to be a bloke on a desert island. There you go.
Yeah, the palm tree. Yeah, some sand.
But then I'd have to have water, wouldn't I?
Have you ever tried drawing sand?
No.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I have a lot of influences, but again, I don't try and... they're influences, but not people who I try and replicate, you know, because I don't think you get anywhere, because then you're just like a Poundland version of something. It never works. I mean, we see it. You know, I look at people and I can see what they're trying to be or who they're trying to be, and it's never quite the same. It doesn't really work. But I mean, I grew up on 2000 AD as my primary source of comics when I was quite small. So I, you know, my main influence is people like Brian Bolland, Steve Dillon, and those two, it's that clean line that they both had. You know, they both had this mastery of the kind of the clean line, and I still think they're doing. And you know, I loved the Squarer's work because it was just more dynamic, you know, so I like that element to it. But then on the American side, you know, I was a big fan of Neil Adams, Jim Aparo, like I say. Those were my kind of Batman kind of artists and stuff.
Yeah.
And then moving forward, I mean, I love things now where there's a strong element of kind of negative space. So, you know, I think you know, when you look at classic people like, you know, Bernie Wrightson and Alex Toth, that kind of stuff. But more up to date, you know, Charlie Adlard's another one who uses a lot of negative space.
Yeah, it does.
But my favourite in that kind of era is a guy called Shane Oakley, who he's just, I think he's the greatest kind of gothic comic artist we've got, you know, and why he's not as famous as he should be.
Totally underrated, in my opinion.
He's, you know, he's worked with Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, and everybody, and he's so unique.
Totally.
You know, in his style. But I love that kind of really strong black and white. And, you know, I can't do it. I couldn't do it, but I can take from it and learn from it. And
it's something to aspire to as well, isn't it?
Yeah, coloured work, you know, people like Alex Ross who paint, you know, fantastic stuff. People like Ryan Brown who paints, you know, I love the way that some people draw the female form, shall we say. So, you know, you've got people like John Royle, fantastic kind of figurative artist.
Mm.
Ian Richardson, another one that we both know quite well, and his dynamic kind of...
Another underrated artist, I think, who should be a superstar, you know.
So many out there. And again, like H said, I get a lot of influence from fellow small press creators like us, you know, because you look at stuff and you go, I really like that.
Well, that keeps you going as well, doesn't it? Like someone on your own sort of level, you almost think, you're not in competition, but they give you a bit of a kick, don't they?
Yeah.
Because you think, I need to up my game because these guys are my peers and look at what they're doing, you know?
And the standard's so high.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. A lot of those guys out there are so good. And I think sometimes it's difficult to tell some small press books from mainstream books.
Yeah.
When you look at the quality of them. Mm. Especially with the printing quality as well. Yeah. Now.
Well, it's blurring, isn't it? It's really blurring. I think,
especially
with what's happening now, with you know, in some ways, you know, with COVID and the way that shops are struggling, and there's this sort of evening out of the battleground, if you like.
Yeah.
And it really is blurring, isn't it? Between what do you call small press, what do you call indie, and what do you call pro? When you've got an indie guy who does it all themselves. Who's selling, I don't know, 20,000 copies of their book through Kickstarter or whatever they're doing it, you know. And then you've got like a Marvel title that's selling 15,000 copies worldwide.
Yeah.
And you think, well, which one's the professional here? You know, it really is sort of blurring, I think.
And there's such a wealth of talent out there as well that varies in style and things like that. I mean, you know, the last con that we did this year, well, the only con that we did, I think it might be infamously the one that
everyone did.
True Believers.
Yeah.
You know, Stuart Mulrain's con. And we went down to that and we were lucky enough to get a table and we were there. And just that day, you know, walking around, you know, Steve Tanner with all the stuff he's got, you know, and then you go and across from him was like Steve Sims, you know, the Battle Badgers.
Yeah.
If anybody's never read Battle Badgers, oh my word. Just pick it up, just for the art alone. It's absolutely exquisite. You know, it takes him a year to do an issue.
Mm.
And you can see why. And there's just such a whole world of creative talent out there in small press. I think it really is where it is, I think, at the moment. You know, sound really
exciting, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been like that for a very long time. I don't think it's been this exciting for a long time. And my worry is that with the current situation and no cons, which means it's difficult to move your work.
Mm.
You know, we've had this where, you know, obviously sales are down because we can't physically go out and sell, you know.
And there's nothing like it, is there? There's nothing like going up to people and talking to them about your book and to sell your book. You know, it doesn't matter how good your marketing is. Doesn't matter how good your website is. You cannot beat that.
No.
No, one-to-one
exactly.
interaction.
I mean, social media, you know, and we have a bit of a love-hate relationship with social media.
Mm,
I hate it as equally as I love it. But you have to be on it to get your work out there. But you still can't beat meeting people.
No.
And, you know, having a human conversation and making friends. Because that's how we've made a lot of friends over the years as well, isn't it?
You put them in a headlock until they buy something.
Buy something.
That's usually my technique.
You don't leave until you buy something. Yeah.
Sorry about that, Shane. I promise I'll do it next time.
Well, we've all done it. We've all done it.
I know.
But you do get these guys, don't you, at the shows sometimes, who do hard sell.
There's one, I mean, we won't name names, but I know there's one infamous person who is a fully fledged you've got to get the product, which once you start calling it a product, you know there's a problem.
Yeah.
But you've got to get your book into the hands, because when you get the book into the hands, they're going to buy it and all that crap. Yeah. And I don't subscribe to any of that. You know, I just chat to people if they want to chat.
Well, I don't want people being frightened of coming up to the table.
Well, it puts them off, I think. You know, I think at the end of the day, you might sell them that book because they're scared, but every time they see you at a con in the future, they're going to give you a wide berth, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. They'll make sure they don't even make eye contact with you.
Yeah.
You
know, it's the way of thing, though, Comic Cons, isn't it? Because it's those things that, you know, you go along to a room full of tables of people selling their own stuff, and the majority of people at Comic Cons walk straight down the centre of the aisle, don't they? So they don't go too near to anybody's table.
You know, don't make eye contact.
Like, half an hour, they just like, they're like sharks. They just sort of go through the room, and then eventually they'll get a bit closer as they circle.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit closer each time, and then eventually they'll come up to the table and start like flicking through. And if you leap all over them at that point, you just scare them to death.
Yeah, you've lost them. Yeah.
You know, a lot of comic fans, they're not used to human interaction, are they?
Or washing.
I'm only joking, comic fans.
Don't I'm only go, joking.
Don't go writing into Shane just because he made me say that. No, you know, you've got to appreciate that not everyone is of the same kind of social
level
where they're happy to talk to strangers. And you've got to give people that. And trying to shove a book at them and make them buy it, I find that
don't have the money as well. And when cons do start again, there's more and more people that probably won't have the money, you know, in the current situation.
Yeah, you've got to go softly, haven't you?
Well, the problem we've given probably more stuff away than we've sold at some cons. Because you do, because
you don't want to take it home.
There is that. But there's also people that, you know, especially younger people who come to the table and they'll pick stuff up.
Mm.
And, you know, they can't afford it. It's not expensive, but they just haven't got the money. But you can tell that there's a spark of interest.
Yeah. And you want them to read it, don't you?
Exactly.
Yeah. And if I can give them something that will encourage
them. Inspire
For all we know, they could be a superstar. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I wouldn't get anybody thanks. But it's not the point. No. You know, the fact is, if you can actually just give someone a start and encourage them, great. You know, because if we don't bring other people into the comics world and
especially the young ones, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
We're dead, aren't we?
Yeah.
We've all been encouraged by somebody. If we look back on our lives, all of us have been encouraged by either one person, whether it be an art teacher or a family member. We've all had somebody that's made us go, oh, I can do this.
You know? I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, as well? If we all think back, you know, everyone listening to this now as well, the moment that you got into comics, would that moment happen for a youngster now? You know, would that opportunity arise? I mean, I look back to how I got into comics, and there were lots of things, actually. It seemed to be banging me over the head, actually. But my cousin had comics, so I was lucky there. But the first time I bought a comic, Spinnerack in Blackpool. Yeah. Spinnerack in Blackpool. Well, that doesn't exist anymore, as far as I know.
No.
And we used to holiday in North Wales. And where I lived, we had no comic. Like, we had a news agent at the end of the road that used to pin them up. He used to actually peg them to a line across the top in the sort of news agents. And you'd stand underneath and go, can I have that? You know, or something. And, my dad used to get me 2000 AD. I don't know where from, but I used to get that. But we didn't have any comics. We didn't have any spinner racks or anything.
Mm.
But when we were on holiday in North Wales, all the holiday camp shop had racks of comics, and that's where I bought, you know, the vast majority of my old kind of DC stuff and stuff I've still got now.
Yeah,
you know, 40 odd years old, and it's because I can remember buying some of it in there.
Yeah,
you know, and we have lost that. And then it got into the kind of mid to late 80s. Every newsagent had comics, didn't they?
They did. They were everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could get them in news agents. You could get them in comic shops. You could get them in other venues as well sometimes.
I got nearly a full run of Sandman just down the news agents. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, these are the kinds of things that you wouldn't get now.
No.
Because now, unless it's got a piece of plastic shit stuck to the front.
Yeah.
You don't get, or it's some reprint, isn't it?
Yeah. The reprint.
Like 6-7 quid. Well, kids can't afford it.
It needs to be cheap, doesn't it? It needs to be accessible. Yeah. I mean, if you think about those impulse buys, I used to buy my comics every week from the Stars shop, because I used to bunk off school at dinner time, go and buy some sweets, and there'd be comics.
Yeah.
You know, and they were 40p.
Yeah.
So for a fiver, you get loads.
I was on free school dinners at one point when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I used to sell my school dinner ticket to save up. and I would spend all my money on either football cards.
Just don't eat, like...
comics on the way home. Yeah. And I remember I'd get in and I'd have like another comic from the paper shop up the road. You know, I'd be looking up at his peg stuff and I'd be like, what's that? You know, and stuff like that. And I'm like, where have you got that from? I'm like, oh, I bought it on the way home. You know, so-and-so gave it me. And she's like, all right. And it was only my mum, the teachers grassed me up for not eating.
Oh, really? How dare they be concerned about your nutritional well-being?
I know, yeah.
I was feeding my mind.
Comics to read. Yeah.
Feeding my mind. I was a fat kid. I feed my mind, not my body. I was all right. I wasn't going to die. But yeah, so it's that. And I don't think kids will have that now because they're not easily accessible. They're not cheap. They're difficult. And, you know, if you've got kids and you took them into a comic shop now and you said, what can I get for 10 quid? It's probably about, if you're lucky, 3 books, isn't it?
I mean, I had the disheartening experience of when my lad was about 7 or 8 years old. I took him to a comic shop for the first time, thinking, oh, this is going to be like it was for me, you know? Because you do project onto your kids a bit, you can't help it. And I walked in and I thought, right, son, pick any comic you like. And he took about half an hour, he walked around, he goes, don't really want anything.
Oh,
I could have cried.
I was going to say, but you were so disheartened.
He said, this is the moment.
I tell you what, mate, I'd have been straight in the DNA testing. Come here. Just put this swab in your mouth.
I mean, I bought him stuff anyway. I said, right, I'm buying you this and this and this, and you fucking read.
You're going to bloody read it. Yeah.
And he still loves comics. He's doing his own. He's making his own comics now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So I brainwashed
the long game. It's weird though, isn't it? But I just don't think it's that accessible, sadly. And it did become a bit elitist for a while as well, which pissed me off. You know,
that doesn't help at all, does it?
No, it doesn't help in anything, does it? Once you start marginalizing.
That whole, you know, oh, these sort of comics aren't good enough because they're not clever enough, superhero comics are all shit, or
can it stand anything? I was listening to a podcast about horror movies, and they were saying the latest thing is elevated horror. Right. What? And I'm thinking, what is this bollocks? Basically, you know, they would see something like a classic, like the greatest horror film of all time, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that has hardly any blood and gore in it, but it's just really frightening and cleverly made.
Yeah.
That would be lowbrow horror. Elevated horror would be something like, I don't know, The Conjuring or something, you know, that
is
really, really clever, but actually doesn't scare you at all because it's boring.
Yeah, and you know what's coming.
And it's like, you know, and so, yeah, clever horror is now, quote, elevated horror. Oh, and if you don't like that, obviously you don't really understand horror. And I'm like, this is what happened with comics, wasn't it? Where it all started eating its own tail a little bit. And, you know, I think the big crossovers were the problem with that as well. Where,
you
had to buy 52 issues.
Oh, it made it inaccessible, didn't it? Yeah, I mean, these comics that, you know, you have to buy 15 to get one story.
Yeah.
It does make it very inaccessible for the younger readers who can't afford to do that, doesn't it?
And it's hard to get them. Yeah. You know, I mean, during lockdown, I've been filling gaps in my comic collection because from 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, I've had comics where I never actually found out what happened. So I had that, you know, I think you might remember, I put a post on about, I was really super excited because I got the issue of JLA that told me what happened. I think it's issue 191 when they actually fight this, you know, the starfish.
That's it,
And it's like, I never knew what happened.
So this explains why you are the way you are then.
All those years you've waited. And was it a bit of a disappointment when you read it as well? Oh, it's a bit
I think that was 1983 or something bizarre like that. But I remember seeing it on the spinner rack, ironically, on holiday, and I couldn't afford it. And it was like, you know, all of 10p, but I didn't have 10p. And I finally got it, and I got the second issue, and I had them both there, and I read them. And I just tweeted out how excited I was, and Brian Bolland came on and went, well, you know, there's a great, I'm thinking, Jesus, you know. But it just, so then I just thought, you know, I'm going to plug a few gaps. So I started plugging your gap because I can now. I'm lucky if I can.
Yeah.
The problem you've got, again, this is another thing that I think is a bad thing for comics, is the whole slabbing kind of thing now. There are going to be.
You can only find it slabbed, and it's like three times as much.
You know what, mate? You know, people who buy them to slab shouldn't be allowed to have them, in my opinion. it's there to be. There was a guy the other day, and he said, "I just bought this comic. He got Spider-Man 300, right?
Mm.
And he said, I've got this comic. and I'm going to get it slabbed. Should I get it slabbed? Should I not get it slabbed? And should I get it pressed first? And all this nonsense. And I had to write on flipping and go, why don't you read it?
Yeah.
You know, because that's kind of what it was intended for, was to be read.
It's the last thing they think of. I mean, it is nauseating. I've stopped commenting on it because, you know, I piss people off, obviously, when I do.
Oh, they get really,
they get very defensive. And, you know, and I do say, you know, it is up to them. It's their comic. They can do what the hell they like, you know. But I couldn't do it.
I foresee 1.0, Shane, where every comic will be slabbed at some point, which means that to buy a cheap reader copy of something is going to be nearly impossible.
Yeah.
And the reprints, I don't like the reprints. I don't like the way that when you look at 1980s books, because they don't calibrate the colours.
No, or it's different colouring.
It's horrible. It's like it's like smacking your face with a colour palette, isn't it?
You know,
it's horrid. And I just think it's such a shame people don't see it in its natural form.
Mm.
And the more that goes on and the more everyone gets obsessed with slabbing and pressing and cleaning and never touching them, don't open them, you know.
No, don't
I've got a Spider-Man 300 here in front of me just in a bag.
Yeah.
You know, and I've no intention of getting it graded because I don't really care. You know, it's mine. But I worry that that's going to put people off. You know, it's going to put new collectors or new people getting into a genre who want to read single issues as they're intended. That's a beautiful thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to put them off. And I'm just, I mean, eventually, like everything, it'll run out of steam a little bit.
Yeah, I think it will. I think, you know, I think it'll become inaccessible because all the books will be too expensive for people to join in on the fun of collecting them. So it'll they'll just belong to all these elite, like wealthy collectors.
Yeah.
And everyone else will just, other people just won't engage with it. They'll just go, well, I can't afford that.
If slab books is your thing and you're not really interested in reading but collecting, that's fine. That's your choice. Mm. But when people are getting things slabbed and graded that come back as a 2.6 and a 3, what's the point? Yeah. The bloody slab's worth more than the comp.
Yeah. Or a new book that's just come out that's worth like £3. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to slab this because it might be popular because there might be a film of one of the characters that appears on the third panel.
I know. It's just bizarre, isn't it? I mean, it's like in the 90s when we all bought Chromium covers and 50 variants of every
issue. We all did it though, didn't we?
I was going through some long boxes and I've got like a box of shame where I've got like 4 or 5 versions of the same thing.
Oh.
Like, why did I buy them?
Why did we do it? Yeah.
You know, body bags and stuff like that, like 3 different variant covers of stuff nobody's even interested in. Yeah. And they're worth less now than when I bought them.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like X-Men number one, isn't it? I remember buying 3 versions of that. I got the pull-out cover, the regular newsstand, and one of the other covers. I think it was like a Magneto cover or something.
Yeah.
The cover I liked, you know. And they're worthless now. There's like 50p, aren't they? Something like that.
Yeah. Great book. But not, you know.
Yeah, great book. But they printed a million or whatever. So how did we think that they were ever going to be worth anything?
Because we didn't
printed that many. Because
we didn't have the internet and we didn't know. And we didn't know. Somebody said to you, this is a variant cover. I would be thinking, there's only probably a handful of these in the world.
Yeah.
Well, 100,000 if you've got big hands. And then, you know, and you look back and you think we were taken for right mugs, weren't we?
Oh, God, yeah.
Proper mugged off by Image and people like that. Yeah. They were laughing all the way, weren't they?
Yeah. Oh, they made a lot of money, didn't they? But it also ended up with, with the industry almost completely imploding.
Exactly. You know, exactly. And this is the thing. And even now, I mean, the thing with COVID and recent developments within comics were decent of a shift in more towards purely digital, which worries me slightly, you know, because I read digital books, but I still love floppies. I still love a physical product.
I'll read them as long as they put them out.
So I'm going to have to punch myself in the face. But, you know, see, they've even got to me now, and I'm old and...
I do it, mate. You're not the only one. You're all right.
I think it's, you know, it's worrying times in the comic industry. And I think, you know, we need to make it as inclusive as we can. And that's all the way from small press right through to the big guns.
Yeah.
And my worry is that the more they just drive for profit, the quality drops, you know, because they'll only actually do the things that are safe, which means new things will never come along. And
well, they're selling to a smaller, you know, if you sell to a smaller audience all the time, that's ever decreasing, you know, and you keep charging that audience more money for less product. And eventually, you know, it's just going to accelerate the audience to, you know, getting smaller and smaller, isn't it? It's real worry, to be honest.
The risk taking goes, you'd never get a preacher now. You'd never get anyone greenlighting preacher or something like that these days. I don't think you would anyway. Not a major publisher. You might get an independent creator doing something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame that we're losing that. And I was talking about it the other day, saying we'll never see anything like Warrior Magazine, you know, which I adore Warrior Magazine.
Yeah.
I love it. But you'll never see anything like that again, where like when Des Skin just did this, like completely original.
It was fantastic, wasn't it?
British comics. And it's a shame to a degree.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of these new ones that are coming out, like the 77 and Shift? Do you think
I've got to say,
they've got a chance of doing something special?
I think they do. And I think, you know, as long as they understand the marketplace and they understand what they're aiming for. And I don't know this way it's going to sound, but I think we all have to do this as creators. You've got to have realistic expectations of how far something will go.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think Ben particularly does that really well with the 77.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually one of the people that I was thinking of getting involved in that early on, and we had discussions, but because we had other work coming, it just never worked out. But you know, I'm quite interested in going back one day and maybe just sort of seeing whether or not they'll let me do a script. Because it is, I think I like it, and you know, I've bought them all so far, and I think it's a great product. Again, I've called it a product, so I'll punch myself again.
carry on.
It's a good comic, and I like it, and I like the feel of it. And I think each issue's got better. You know, I think the first issue was good. Some of the art and the writing might have been a bit questionable, which is fair enough, you know, because it's a new venture.
But
each issue's getting better and better. And I've
getting stronger, isn't it?
The third one landed last week, and I've got it on my pile to read, and I've had a flick through, and that's great. And, you know, there's lots of really good artists out there, and there's quite a few analogies. I mean, I've had a look through things like, you know, Zarjaz and Dog Breath and things like that. And, you know, there's some good stuff in there. You know, Futurequake does some good stuff. You know, I'm just trying to think. Edge of Extinction, I love that series. I think that's great. And there's just so many. I mean, I'm missing loads of people. So apologies if I do.
There are so many, aren't there? Yeah, you could
Battle
go on
Badges,
forever.
I adore Battle Badges. Yeah. I just think that's so good. Because I never got on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle wagon. I always missed that.
We're a bit old for that, weren't we? I mean, because when that came out, we were probably just a little bit old for it, you know.
Yeah, but I'm talking about when it was the independent, before it actually became the kind of popular medium.
Yeah,
but when you look at the earlier stuff and that first launch, it's quite gritty and
the
Eastman stuff. There's a lot of subtext to that.
I wished
I'd kind of picked it up and I didn't. But Battle Badge is another one that I just think is amazing. There's so many good creators out there. I mean, I spend more money on small press than I do mainstream comics now. I want to support the industry because that's where I think people really, really do it for the love of doing it. It's not a machine. And secondly, I mean, a lot of the big companies I've just lost a little bit of faith in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Batman. I love Batman. My favourite character.
Oh, yeah.
I adore Batman. Can't read now. Because pardon my French, I don't know what the fuck's going on. Because they've pissed around the canon that much now that it's worthless.
It's really hard to follow it. I dabbled a couple of times in Batman, and I followed. And there's some good individual issues. You know, there was a run that Lee Weeks was drawing, which was beautiful. You know,
But I
really struggled with the story and the writing.
It's too long, and you know, some of the arcs are just too long. Everything has to be like a 16.
Yeah,
you know, kind of issue arc or 20
the art
issue
of just drawing a 22,
and 24 page, you know,
story.
No disrespect to people, but you know, I don't want Batman growing a fucking mustache and riding a horse, and you know, marrying Catwoman over like what seemed 3 years.
Oh,
you
that went on, didn't it?
And it just, I find it all just a bit too boring, to be honest.
Ponderous,
and,
I think.
The writing's great and the art's beautiful, but it just doesn't grab me. It doesn't keep me there. The old, you know, two and done or one and done did. And, you know, and the way that around with canon things, I mean, I haven't a clue what goes on with X-Men anymore. I used to love that book. And I've started, you know, I thought the Jonathan Hicks reimagining was fantastic.
I read all those.
But I've trailed off that now because it got to, I couldn't understand. I think I'm getting old and I couldn't follow it anymore. I didn't know what was going on. But those first few books, The House of X, and that, I thought were brilliant. You know, when people take seminal moments like the death of Robin, which was brilliant, death in the family, I still think that's one of the greatest sort of story arcs ever read. And then, years later, they piss all over it because they want to bring him back.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, you're just on a hide into nothing then. And I think that's the flaw with big companies, is that they keep going back to the same wells.
Yeah. Well, they haven't got a choice now, have they? Because of their model. You know, I think I've spoke about this before with other guests on the podcast. You know, they haven't got much choice because they're at a point now where no creators want to create new things for them because, well, why would you when you can do it yourself with Image or Dark Horse or, you know, or for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
It just kills you, doesn't it? You don't actually own anything, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Which is why Image, I think, are still quite strong in some respects. You know, people like that and Dark Horse, where, you know, there's that more of a collaborative approach to creation.
Yeah, I think publishers now, in modern publishers, have to look at themselves as partners with the creators. You know, I think that is the way forward. I think you know, if you're going to be a publisher, you're not, you know, a separate entity. You are part of that creative team and you are in it together. And I think publishers that approach it that way, like Image have done, will succeed and will continue to succeed, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas publishers who just want to sort of take from the creator and, you know, and then sell at an increase, you know, because that's basically what was a transaction, isn't it? It's like, I'm going to buy your IP and then I'm going to sell it into infinity forever and make loads of money out of your IP. That's their model.
Yeah.
But creators are wise to that now.
And that's the thing Pat Mills has just done, hasn't he, with Space Warp.
Stuck
in my head. And I knew it wasn't with Space Warp. And he's gone back to that model, hasn't he, where, you know, the creators own the rights to the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it becomes a success, I'm sure it will do, with Pat Mills behind it, you know, they've got some stake in those characters moving forward. And that's the model that I know, you know, talking to John Wagner, that we both know, you know, that's the bugbear that him and Pat have had for years, isn't it? You know, they technically don't own a lot of the work they did.
That's it. They don't own their own creations.
It's outrageous, isn't it? It's outrageous. Yeah. But, you know, that's the model.
Yeah.
So you've obviously published small press stuff for people in the past, and you know how it.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those. I think we're in a slightly different world where, you know, people like us and yourself and other people listen to this, because I'm sure a lot of independent creators listen to your show, you can actually do stuff now and get your work out. And it's hard. And you're going to lose money on it. Like, you're not going to, you know, let's be honest, you're not going to pay your mortgage doing it. But if you love doing it, you love people, even if one person buys our books, we're thrilled to bits. Because it's just, you know, it's when, you know, somebody says, I really enjoyed that. You know, that's the spark you need to
you get your real pencils high up
and
go
again, you know. And it is a slog, but it's worth it. You know, it's worth it just to create. And
definitely. So you guys both in it for the long haul then?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's with starting the business and stuff, it's the only legitimate way that we can take payment for stuff that we do.
Yeah.
So if we, you know, we ended up looking at closing it, I don't know how we'd then proceed forward. I don't know how we'd be able to continue to do that. We need some way of producing stuff.
And, yeah.
You know, putting in our tax return every year and that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, I foresee it. I mean, we're like Damien's just said, it ain't going to pay the mortgage. We're not going to become famous millionaires off this, but if people go into that thinking they're going to be very severely
it's not the reason to go into it, is it?
No, exactly. It really isn't. And I think you go into it for the love of it, and it's a real love, isn't it, you know?
And it is, you know, good for you.
It's
you know,
well,
mental health thing. It's amazing. I mean, it helped me, as I say, when I was in a weird place, and it pulled me out of a bit of a, you know, hole. You know, as frustrating as art can be, because it is frustrating, anything creative, it's a great thing to do. And I would encourage anyone that wants to do it, just do it.
Just do it. Yeah. Don't worry about how good you are. No,
absolutely.
Don't worry about what equipment goes wrong and
stuff. Yeah. We've all got stories to tell, haven't we?
And yeah.
Some are better than others, you know.
Yeah.
But do you know what? Just tell it, because you'll feel, it's like writing stuff down. You'll just feel better when you've done it.
Yeah. Definitely.
And do you know what? Every now and then, somebody will make that breakthrough from the independent scene, and it's brilliant to see.
Oh, it happens all the time, doesn't it?
Oh, and it's, and isn't it a great feeling? I mean, I know some people don't see it that way. The jealousy thing kicks in sometimes, but I love when I see people do well. It's like, I think, Jesus, you know.
Yeah, they've done
it. Talking to Dan Cromwell, you know, and he was like, you know, Dan's story about I was driving a bus and then, you know, and I
That's
said
a great
him,
story.
I said, you know what, mate, you've inspired us to actually keep doing it because you represent us. You represent the people that think I'm never going to be a success at, well, anything basically, but I'm never going to be a success in my art career. And then you look to someone and you think, well, they did it.
Yeah.
And they tried and just kept working. I'm not saying I'm as good as Dan Coleman. I don't misinterpret.
But he was a peer. That's the thing. It's one of your peers, isn't it? Someone from your group of people that you're working alongside in the community. Yeah. And when you see them succeed, it's
Oh, it's brilliant.
It's great.
Do you know what? If one of us wins, we all win to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, because that means that they're going to come back and have a look at what the other independent creators are doing because they realise there's a wealth of talent there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just think it's good for us all. And I don't really understand that whole jealousy bit, but that's human nature, I suppose.
You'll always get that.
I just think it's wonderful when I see people do well. I get, you know, I get really pleased. And what does annoy me, why I'm on my soapbox, are the people that they'll do one book and then they'll either bitch that it's not sold millions and they can't understand why, or they'll immediately start like tagging in Netflix or something. And you're like, bloody hell, do you know what I mean? It's like you've done one book, like at least, you know, show a bit of respect to the industry and have a good crack at it.
My favorite ones are the ones who like they get one gig, one pro gig, and then they retire from comics. It's like I'm retiring from comics now. I've done comics.
And,
I'm good.
And I'll tell you the other thing annoys me. The flip side, we talked about this before, about people who were established in other creative fields who then suddenly decide the comic writers or comic artists or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, yeah, you've got your career, mate, and doors are going to open for you because
of who you are.
Of who you are, not necessarily how good you are.
And
that kind of, so on that sense, I get a little bit, you know, irritated. But when it's people that they're just doing it because they love it and they work hard at it. Do you know, I've got nothing but respect for anyone that puts the work out there.
And
it's great.
It's great. I love it.
You know,
And it's a great community.
Throw some money my way for
So before we go, actually, we need to plug what you're doing. So if you can let us know where we can find you guys on the internet, what you're working on at the moment and what people can buy from you.
Yeah. So we've got a website, which is, again, it's one of these necessary evils that you need to have, you know, your work out there and stuff.
Yeah.
So we're at all the W's, art92.com, and that's all letters, there's no numbers in there.
Yeah.
And then similarly on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, we are at art92, again, all one word. We have got our own separate accounts as well, but we try and kind of bring it all together with art92, and you can find our separate accounts off there.
Yeah. Cool.
And as far as what we're working on at the moment, like Damien mentioned, we need to pull our fingers out and get a bit more work done on Pre-Mortis 2. But
we had
plans to kind of get that done this year. But I mean, I think everybody's plans have gone out the window this year with everything.
And is that going to be a Kickstarter when you do it?
Possibly. We haven't decided. We might do, because when we first did that, we just self-published it, and it did quite well. But obviously, you don't get the reach. I mean, the good thing with Kickstarter is, you know, it's a nightmare to work out the bloody finances, but you do get that reach. I mean, like I said with GGA, you know, 3/4 of my sales were American. Well, I'd never have sold those if I did it self-published.
Yeah, so definitely.
It's just good for that whole, you know, getting your work out there.
Yeah, expanding your audience.
We might do. Mm. And especially as I don't think we're going to have any cons, you know, until at least, you know, after summer next year, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? If you haven't got a con to sell them at, Kickstarter is a good way of, like, kickstarting it is.
The way we'll probably try and do it though is get the book almost finished before we kickstart it, or finished before we kickstart.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
So that, you know, people don't have to wait if we make the target. And if we don't, we could just self-publish and try and find it in.
Yeah, you've done the work then, haven't you? And you've got work to show off as well. You've got pages that you can show off. It's going to be a lot more successful that way.
Entice people in.
So we've got Pre-Mortis 2. I'm working currently just noodling with Galaxy Grappling Alliance issue 3, which we call Galactic Rumble. So I'm kind of changing the style of it a little bit, as in the style of the story. So it'll be a bit less all-out action and a bit more about character development. So I think I need to start building that in.
That sounds good.
Also got a couple of ideas in the back of my head I'm noodling with about doing just another couple of horror-based stories and stuff. Mm. But again, you know, because writing is my strong point, I need to sit and think it through.
Yeah.
But H is obviously just swamped with.
I've got a lot
pet
of commissions.
At the moment.
Yeah.
You got a lot.
Again,
yeah.
I'm not complaining about because I'm.
Well, it's get to the time of year, isn't it? Where you get. Absolutely. I mean, because I do like portraits and stuff like that, and this time of year. Crazy.
It's great. So I put a thing out kind of sort of September and again in October saying, look, if you want your commissions for Christmas, you better get, you know, not thinking that I'd get a lot of bites. Blimey, I did, you know, and I've got, I finished another commission today and I'm starting another one tomorrow. So that's keeping me really super busy.
Well, that's good.
And then I need to also, on my list, I do a to-do list. And on my list of to-dos, I need to upload some more videos because I've got a Patreon channel as well. So. Yeah. I need to, again, that's under patreon.com/art92.
Right.
And I need to upload my next lot of videos because I try and upload at least once a month. And if I can, I try and upload some stuff in the middle as well. And it's just purely tutorial stuff about how to draw animals.
That's great.
We've got a YouTube channel, which H puts free drawing sort of stuff on there, teaching people to draw. And obviously I've got the podcast that I do, Omen to That, where we a bit similar to yourself. We just have creatives on there and we talk about
it. It's a great podcast, mate. Anyone listening to this, make sure that you subscribe to Damien's podcast.
Fun. And it's like yours. We try and keep it very organic, really. So
just a chat.
Know, we don't script it. We just allow people to get. We give, you know, we give them a kind of framework of things
you
we want to talk
put
about.
The we in there. It's all yours.
and then you know, then comes the fun of editing it, which takes a God in the bloody thing.
Oh God, definitely.
But I enjoy it. It's nice to, it's just nice to talk to people. And I started doing it just because, like, firstly, I needed to talk to someone other than H. You know, you know her, Shane. And secondly, I just thought, you know, if this kind of is something that might give someone else a bit of enjoyment, then why not?
I had a similar motivation myself for doing this, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
a bit
nice
of time.
To catch up with people, isn't it?
It is.
And every now and then you get to talk to heroes like I had Graham Humphreys on and people like that.
That was a good one,
you know,
mate.
And that's really good because you get to introduce people to other people's work through it as well.
Yes. Yes.
So, but we're trying to keep busy, aren't we?
Definitely keeping busy.
Good. Good. You're both looking very well. For those who can't see, because it's an audio podcast, they both look very well and much younger than their years.
You're too kind, Jay. Too kind.
I have rubbed Vaseline on the camera, though.
And on that note, I think it's time to say goodnight. We've gone well over our hour, but it's been an absolute pleasure, guys. It really has.
It's been good catching up.
It's always good to catch up with you guys. It really is. So thank you so much for coming on.
No, thanks, Shane. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Took your time, mate.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah, you know him.
Why weren't we first?
You know him. 30 years.
Well, do you know what? Just before we go, there was a guy I used to work with, and they were having a Zoom meeting. Mm. So they'd meet up with people. And it was like a virtual drinking thing. So it was like they used to go to the pub on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
So every Wednesday, they'd invite one person from work. And I was like, Where's my invite? So what I did was I decided that they were keeping the best till last.
I was
the final person they invited on, obviously.
Obviously.
For my sparkling, you know.
Wit and personality.
Shafts of wit, as they used to say. Was it wafts of shit?
It's one of them.
Well, no, like yourself, keep going, mate, and keep up the good work, you know. You can never have enough podcasts. You know
well,
I mean?
They reckon that, don't they? So we'll test that theory.
Well, we are testing it, aren't we? I mean, they don't say anything about quality, do they? So, that was my get out. Never said it was good.
We'll just keep doing it.
Yeah, it'll be worse. We'll be doing videos.
hey. Right, guys. So I will hopefully see you again in the flesh soon. Let's see how the next sort of 6 months goes, eh? But keep in touch and stay well,
And you, Shane.
Stay safe, mate.
All the best, guys.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye.